Dr. Brian Baker is with us today. Most of you know that he is in his 12th year as director of music here at the UU Church of Berkeley. He's also in his 14th season as artistic director and conductor of Masterworks Chorale, assistant conductor of the San Francisco Choral Society, and is founder and director of the Serenade Chamber Choir. He's also a conductor. He's conducted several orchestras, including the Kensington Symphony Orchestra here. He's also a concert pianist, and he's had solo concerts, chamber music. He's accompanied vocal recitals across the United States, Europe, and South America. He has bachelor's, master's, and PhDs in music. And he was on the faculty of the College of San Mateo for 12 years. He's taught voice at San Francisco State, Foothill College, and he also has a private studio. So we are indeed very, very fortunate to have Brian, as we call him. We don't call him Dr. Baker, we call him Brian, as the director of our music program. I also want to mention that he's also an actor, and he would just play Charlie Brown in You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, and that was a lot of fun. So without further ado, please welcome Brian Baker.
Hello, y'all. Can you hear me fine?
Yes.
Good. So I want to thank you especially for being here. I thought there might be nobody here today because of what happened Tuesday, and because it's the food truck day today. I reminded my partner, Rod, you know, it's the food truck. It's bring your weight in food. And he heard food truck and said, tacos? I like that idea. So I'm honored to be asked to do personal theology. It's a little ironic because I have never been able to attend personal theology because it has always been at the same time as the choir rehearsal in the morning. Now there's a time shift. It's the same time as the first service. So fortunately, I don't always have to play for the first service. For a while, I've needed to, but which means I can finally attend, which I think is really wonderful. And I feel a great deal of humility in being asked because I know some of the people who have done this before, and they're quite remarkable, and I certainly don't think I have that kind of gravitas or excitement to bring, but I will bring what I have because that's the best I can do. And I will confess that it's really hard to focus on this after the election because all I want to do is yell and scream and stomp my feet and cry. But I will do my best not to do those things right now. And this is about shared vision through collaboration. And I think that that's important, maybe even more important now. But I have found it's increasingly important in my life, not just as a practical thing, but also in my own kind of spiritual development. You might have gathered that I'm a musician. And because music is so important to me, I wanted us to sing a little bit. I promise it won't be very much. It won't be very hard. Gathered here in the mystery of the hour, gathered here in one strong body, gathered here in the struggle and the power. Oh, my goodness, that's true. And Spirit, draw near. I think most of you sung it, and I brought reinforcements. Rod is here. He will help me lead the song. So you don't need to get up or anything? Rod, if you would get up, that'd be great. So let's all sing it together. If you don't know the words, you will by the second time.
Gathered here in the mystery of the hour, gathered here in one strong body, gathered here in the struggle and the power, Spirit, draw near.
Great. So we are a big enough strong body that we can split into two. So this side will start. This side will come.
Gather here in the mystery of the hour.
y'all. Thank you, Rod. It's so nice when the parts work well together. And I want to talk a little bit about that. So whatever is holy or revered or godlike, to me, I find in certain places, I find it in nature and in beauty and in the creative energy and in goodness from people, which strikes me again and again. I'm constantly surprised and delighted. And also the one which I find more difficult to explain, which is the process of becoming, the way things change. I know things are always changing, but there's some sort of special changes which happen. And collaborating and looking for a shared vision really impact a couple of those. The creative process, and then this becoming. Because when you do a shared collaborative process in the ways that I'm going to be talking about mostly, which is what two equal groups or three or four equal groups, it's not that one dictates, but that you come together and you create something from your shared visions that becomes your individual visions. It becomes a shared vision. It's also a great deal about the inherent worth and dignity of every person, because you don't always come into these collaborative ventures thinking that you're collaborating with an equal. Or you may think you're collaborating with an equal and then you find out, we're not really very much the same. And that's, I think, very often where the greatest worth comes from. So just a tiny bit about collaborating. We collaborate, all of us, all the time in our relationships, planning a trip together. You have an idea, your partner has an idea, and after a while there's a compromise collaboration somewhere in the middle. I know in some relationships it's not. I have an idea. Okay, here's the idea. But that's not my relationship. And then in art, musical things, which is what I know most about, artistic collaborations, there are all sorts of kinds. And most of us do a certain amount in our work. We have a superior, and they say, let's work on this project. And you wind up, they are going to make the final decision. They're going to lead the focus and the vision, but we're all joining in the work. When you get two sort of equal group leaders, it's a little bit of a different dynamic, because who's going to lead the thrust of things and who's going to make the final decision? And somebody has to, actually both people, have to relinquish a certain amount of power, which is kind of ephemeral anyway, especially in what I do. And it's so good when you do that. And I like examples, so I will be giving examples of all of those things. The idea of collaboration started for me a long time ago because I was very bad at it. And I think I've become good at it, and I think it's made me a much better person. It certainly has made me come deeper into myself and my own understanding of what I think is valuable in the world. So I started playing the piano in high school, which is very late. And when you study music as a soloist, there is a lot of creative, or most often recreative, work that you do. And this I find fascinating and very satisfying, and it really brings me into a deep connection with whatever is holy or reverent or godlike. And I want to give you a specific example. So one of the pieces I learned in college was a Bach fugue. In Bach's day, you didn't get a dynamic marking, you didn't get a tempo marking, you didn't get anything to indicate the character of the music. You just got the notes on the page, which are wonderful. So I'm going to play a little bit of a Bach in a couple different ways. This is a fugue in G minor from the Well-Tempered Clavier, Book 1. Don't worry if that means nothing to you.
nothing wrong with that interpretation. Here's something else.
I don't think there's anything wrong with either one of those interpretations. Here's one more. I don't think there's anything wrong with that one. And I remember looking at those three, and I started with the first one. And I thought, this is the way this piece goes. This is so cool. And I took it to my teacher, who said, well, have you considered? And then I considered something else. And I said, no, I like it the first way. And I played it for friends. And they said, oh, that's really great. And then one of them said, have you considered this? And she did some suggested something else. And I thought about it, and I went away and said, no, I like the first way better. And I played it for an audience, and they really liked it. And then somebody said, have you considered it another way? Because there's so many possible ways. But when you are the solo performer, it's you and your sense of integrity and however you relate to whatever is important that decides that for you. You really need to decide. Of course, other music also is open to interpretation. This is Swonderful, the song by Gershwin in his own arrangement. I'm just going to play a little bit of this one in different ways. Here's another way. And again, I don't think either one is wrong. They're just options that you look through to decide what you're going to want to do. When you collaborate with people, they may really have a strong preference for one or the other. This is not entirely different from politics. I will try not to talk about politics sometimes.
Oh, I don't need this one.
So what I found in collaborations, both the kinds which are equal and the kinds which are a little bit less equal but still kind of balanced, is that people... Well, in general, people don't like to collaborate because they have to give up power and it's much harder. But when we do collaborate, people tend to want to collaborate where they feel really like it's going to be a great close connection. So I once did something with a famous opera singer that you may not have heard her, named Jing Chao, and a cellist who's very well known in the Bay Area, Emil Milan. And we did a Brahms song, which is a very equal thing. There's a piano part, a cello part, and a voice part. All of them could be played just by themselves, and they'd be beautiful. And we sat down in her living room to do this the first time, and afterwards we looked at each other, and she said, it's like old friends. We never rehearsed it. We just all had such similar feelings for the music. It was just already there. It was great. It was like... we were blue, robin's egg blue, and slate gray blue, and navy blue, and it was so easy to meld these blues together. But I've also worked with people where if they were kind of red and I was kind of blue, it wasn't so easy, and you had to look for the match. And I did one of these just over the summer on a big Mahler project, and I lost a lot of sleep on that one because it was not an easy collaboration. In this case, it was not a balanced collaboration. The other person was the final decision maker. But I learned a great deal with that. And I had to figure out inherent worth and dignity and remind myself about that every time I disagreed with his interpretation. And indeed, when it came time for performance, it was a very good performance. So even though along the way I hated a lot of what he was talking about and doing, it had valid energy to it and reason. And so I had to remember my role was to create a shared vision, and we did, because his interpretation did shift with my input. Maybe not as far as I wanted to go. But the result is that, what I want to say is, although I felt I was very much one way and he was very much another way, in truth, we shared far more than we disagreed on. And I think that's true in the country. If you look at a map of the election and you see all these blue states and all these red states, the great majority of them are very purple states. If Hillary got 49 and Trump got 51, that's a pretty purple state. Even though on the map it shows as red or blue, it's very much a purple country. Even if it's a little more blue in some places. Thank goodness. So I study the piano because I'm partly because I'm largely an introverted person. But I'm also have a desire to be an extrovert. And I did theater a lot in high school. And that satisfied that impulse. And then in college I had to choose because everything happened at the same time. I chose music. And then the next challenge was solo music versus chamber music. So I was talking about solo. You do it by yourself. They try to make pianists and everybody do some sort of collaborative work, chamber music. Now, you have a teacher, so it's not entirely collaborative. They tell you basically what you're going to do and with who. And the first thing I was assigned was to do two piano stuff with a guy I didn't like and whose playing I wasn't sure I respected. And I just hated that experience, and I was a jerk. And I was. I was young and foolish, and I wish I knew that guy now and could apologize for being such a dork about it. And I was inflexible. And, you know, I don't think what we did was terrible in terms of a musical performance, but the process was not good, and so there was no point. Well, I shouldn't say that. There was limited point in it. It certainly didn't deepen my spiritual awareness or our artistic growth. Then there's also chamber music, which is a little bit different. So these are different instruments which work together to create some music. And so one piece I did more recently, with hopefully a little bit more maturity, is Schumann's Piano Quintet, which has always been one of my favorite pieces. Now, in a string quartet, this is string quartet and piano. In a string quartet, there are four players, the first violin, the second violin, the viola, and the cello. And usually, the dominant personality is the first violinist, and so that person leads the ensemble. And then, usually, the second violinist is a little bit more willing to go along. And then sometimes the violist gets cranky and sometimes the cellist speaks up. This is very gross generalization. Well, then you throw a piano into the mix and the pianist is used to having his or her way. And so there's a great deal of discussion. And I remember watching a video one time of a group of famous musicians doing a rehearsal of this piece. And was wonderful because they rehearsed from where I was. It sounded wonderful. Immediately after they got to the last chord, all of them stood up and started arguing. And looking for their shared vision. And in that case, they were pretty much three equal participants. So I want to play just a little bit of this for you, and I'll get the mic to make sure it's all recorded.
I brought
some electronic assistance because I think examples are very good. This is Robert Schumann's Piano Quintet, the one I was talking about a moment ago. A wonderful recording, Emerson Quartet.
Thank you.
so I want to talk a little bit about my own experience in working on this piece with the musicians I worked on with it. So I'm going to go over to the piano.
Still can hear me? Great. So this...
It gets very cranky if I turn it upside down. All right. So this is the piano part at the opening. And I'm going to play a little slower so we can hear all this. The violin one part is this.
That's just a tiny bit of the music. So we have the same melody for most of it. We have different markings in our scores from Robert Schumann. So my part has accents on a few notes and then not. And his part has accents on a few notes and then not, but they're different notes. In rehearsal, this was my feeling about the music, and I'll continue to play a little bit slower. His interpretation was more like this. I felt that was not right. and we rehearsed as a quartet, and indeed in this as a quintet.
And in this quartet, it was true that he was the leader, the second violinist, pretty much did whatever she was asked. Once in a while, the viola spoke up and the cellist got cranky. She really did. She got cranky. Yes, she did, very much. And so as we rehearsed this piece, I talked about my different interpretation, and he talked about his different interpretation, and we remained a little bit red and blue in this. And I got frustrated. I know he got frustrated. We're friends. It was awkward. So we got ready for a dress rehearsal for a concert, and the violist's wife showed up, thank goodness, and as she was sitting out in the audience, we asked how the balance was, because we can't really tell from on stage how it sounds in the audience in terms of balance. She said, I think the piano's too loud, and I was astonished. And I had to really look inside and say, why was I playing too loud? Because I rarely do that in performance. And I realized it was because I didn't like the violinist's interpretation. I was trying a little bit to drown him out and force my interpretation. And so she said this. She's a lovely woman. And so I pulled back. And when I pulled back and stopped insisting, he pulled back and stopped insisting. And all of a sudden, the music came alive. And so I realized that although I was blaming him, it was me who was getting in the way, and my problem with not recognizing the interdependent web of all music, and this sense that everybody's got an inherent worth and dignity, and you've got to look and listen and find out what's there. I want to talk a little bit about another kind of collaboration, and this is as an accompanist. Throughout my time, my solo teachers have always said, why do you waste your time playing for singers? And the singing teachers say, why do you bother doing solo music? You're an accompanist. But I love both. So I've asked Rod if we can do a song, and we're going to do it a little, just part of it, and we're going to do it a little bit differently both ways. And the reason I want to do this is to show when you do a song, the piano part is very often just sort of the support for the singer, but not always. Sometimes there's never really. That's only how it appears. And very often, there's a really shared communication between people, which is kind of what you hope for in the appropriate repertoire. So Rod and I are going to do a song by Gabriel Fauré. I'll read a little bit of the interpretation and we'll sing through a portion of the song. Clair de Lune is a sort of fanciful thing.
The text is pretty fanciful. It's about, well, I'm only going to read a little bit of it because then you will understand, I think, even better the difference we're going to make. And the other book, great, here you go. So the opening of the text is, your soul is a chosen landscape where charming masquerades and dancers are promenading, playing the lute and dancing. So this is a portion of Clair de Lune by Fauré. Wonderful piano part. It's also a solo piano piece in the same version. And now another interpretation. Let me read a little bit more of the opening text. So continuing where we stopped, playing the lute and dancing and almost sad beneath their fantastic disguises, while singing in the minor key of triumphant love and a pleasant life, they seem not to believe in their happiness. See how it's almost a completely different song. And so in this case, it really, most singers, including Rod, would respond to the way the pianist begins the song with that long introduction. And it would be one version or another. And ideally, as you go along, you create something together. Because if I played the piano the way I did the second time, and Rod wanted to sing it the way we did the first time, it would be very strange and unsatisfying. And so when it's an equal collaboration, you get to sort of figure this out together, sometimes at the very moment of creation. Thank you, Rod. As director, so I do a lot of collaboration here. I don't want to talk so much about the collaboration here because some of the people I collaborate are not in the room, and so that seems inappropriate. But I will just talk about this morning a little bit because I don't think Kristen or Christian would mind a bit. So we had an order of service set on Monday and some plans, and Tuesday we realized it might not stay the same. And so Friday morning, there was a pretty much brand new version. I talked with them on Thursday, and they told me what they were thinking, and I thought of the music and planned the music and came up with an order, and they said, that sounds great.
And on Saturday morning, we changed that around a fair bit. So I'll tell you just a little bit about this. Normally, there's not so much changing. It's because we have to respond to what's happened. So there's a piece called Prayer by Morton Lordson, set to a poem by Dana Joyo, the California poet laureate, that's paired with Sure on the Shining Night, which is a James Agee poem. And I had suggested that we do the first one, and then a reading or a portion of the meditation, and then the second one. And they thought that was a great idea. And then there was going to be another piece that was going to go at the beginning of service called, well, if you're at service, you'll hear it, called Hope by Yisei Barnwell, the leader of Sweet Honey in the Rock. If you want hope to survive, you've got to work on, you've got to pray on. If you want hope to survive, you've got to sing on, you've got to teach on. And the we were going to do that at the beginning of service to sort of increase the spirit. And then I read the beginning of the journey yesterday because it was available. And I said, oh, no, we have to do hope after the beginning of the journey because it ties in so well. And then I went back to the idea of putting prayer in that spot to connect with what follows, which is the meditation and prayer rather than the offertory, which is the usual thing. The offertory is moved later because of the food bank, the food truck with the tacos, you remember. I moved everything, and then I moved it all back again because I had to sort of think through what's going to work. Does it work better for this piece of music to be this part, the first portion, and an end to the first portion, or does it work better for it to start the next portion? And that's really interesting. And every minister, the ministers who are here or the guest ministers who come in, it's a different sort of interaction. Sometimes people don't care. Whatever you want to, that's fine. And other times ministers care a great deal and they really want to work out the best possible flow. And so Kristen and I talked yesterday about how to figure out how to make this work, and we thought we came up with a good plan. Then I got a text on second thought. And then this morning, just on my way over here, she said, Brian, there's a new plan. Usually this doesn't happen. Usually it's fine, but there's this creative moment where different ideas are coming in. And I really like Kristen and Christian, and different times I work more with one or the other. But so I said to Kristen, we're talking about what to do at the end of service because we're going to go out and bless the food in the food truck. And so we took away the postlude, and then we were going to end with the last hymn that they had planned, which is a good one, My Life Flows On, an Endless Song. And then after a while, that somehow didn't feel right. And I said, well, we could do what we've done sometimes in the past, which is welcome table, which is a good sort of walking around song. And it's about having sharing. And that seemed good. And then that didn't seem good anymore. And we were going to do another one. And so we're going to do one now, which is not a great walking song. There is more love somewhere. But people know it, and it will refer back to music earlier in the service. So although it's going to be really different, I think it'll work really well. And it's really interesting because we did not talk about ending with that hymn, but I'd already planned to use that hymn earlier in service for the choir to sing. And so it's really nice when these connections develop. Just because Kristen, it was mostly Kristen in this case, Kristen and I have kind of gotten a connection that feels good, even when we have some pretty different ideas about things. As a director of a choral organization, I've done a lot of collaborating. I mentioned just a little bit with the Mahler, and I want to talk about Carmina Burana. Most of you have heard, is anybody unfamiliar with Carmina Burana? No shame in that. Unfamiliar? No, unfamiliar with Carmina Burana. She sang Carmina Burana. Carmina Burana also seems very appropriate to the season. 8 years ago, there was a Democratic Congress and president, and now it's quite the reverse. And Carmina starts off with the Wheel of Fortune that you, and the text says, first you're at the very top, and then a little later you're at the very bottom. And this is just how things work with the Wheel of Fortune. It's a medieval philosophy, though it's much older than that, but the specific text is from medieval times. So I did Carmina Burana with the chorus I worked with a lot in the Peninsula Masterworks Chorale many years back, and we paired it and we shared it with another chorus. And so the conductor of the other chorus conducted the first half, and we talked about a piece to go on the first half. I conducted the second half. She conducted the first half. What would go with it? Well, we found a piece called Meditation and Dance of Life by David Conti, a Bay Area composer, which both of us really like. And we really liked the piece and how it connected. It has a lot to do with death and life and the joy in life, regardless of how its situations are like. And I had been lucky enough to be there for the premiere, both of the original part version of that piece for forehand, piano, percussion, and men's chorus, and again for the orchestra version. So I was playing the piano in all those cases. And so I felt like I kind of knew the piece pretty well. And she conducted it, and it wasn't the way I thought it should go. And so the way these things work is I prepare my side, my chorus, and she prepares her chorus. And part of the way through, we get together for a Saturday, and we all sing together. And I conduct part of the rehearsal, and she conducts part of the rehearsal. Then we have dress rehearsals, which is where the sort of nitty-gritty final work happens and where the orchestra is there. And I had to bite my tongue and listen and watch. And the conductor came, the composer came, and he really liked it. And I thought, wow, I was there when you conducted the premiere, and it wasn't like this. But that doesn't mean that it's the only right way the music can go. So we did foray a couple different ways. And new music has the same life to it. After the first performance, it's sort of a living testament to the creative energy that was. And now it's a recreative energy. So that was a great collaboration for me growing. And for me and the other conductor, who's a wonderful friend of mine, Gesundheit, the way we found, and I know I did things in Carmina that she didn't care about or care for. And so it was a really good blend for both of our choruses and both of us. After that, many years later, I did two Carminas in pretty close succession, and both of them were a little unusual. One of them had costumes for some performers and not for others, and different costumes for different people depending on what was available. And we had masks, and we were asked to participate in the drama, which is a little hard when you're wearing a mask and nobody can see your expression and you're 100 yards away from everybody else who's going, because the chorus is way up and the orchestra's down and the soloists are in front. And the soloists weren't doing anything dramatic anyway, so I wasn't sure what we were responding to. And then I did another one with a very famous conductor, and this one was in New York with the choruses from all across the country. And this one was really kind of a crisis for me. We did a concert, no costumes, no staging, just every so often the conductor wanted something different. So he had the chorus at one point when we weren't singing just turn around facing away from the audience. And then there was a time where he wanted the baritone soloist to come up and chat with him before he sang his solo, and they would have a pretend argument about stuff. And there were a few things like that that we didn't really understand what the heck was going on, but we did what we were told, and we did this piece in Lincoln Center, and the audience loved it. And I was very frustrated, and I spent the next day, I was in New York City. I love New York City. It's a great walking city. I walked for 7 hours, pretty much nonstop, with pants I had just bought that gave me a rash. But I walked and walked because this really felt to me like an artistic crisis, because it's good to do stuff like this, to bring life into a performance of a piece which at this point is a pretty old piece. But why? Is this entertainment? Is this artistry? Is this integrity? Is really what it came down to me. And so I struggled with inherent worth and dignity, and my own deepest sense of what's most valuable. And much like, sorry, I shouldn't say this, but much like news reporting, which has much more to do with entertainment value than actual substance, I felt that that Carmina performance was much more glitchy,
with glib little bits of entertainment than anything that really served the music in a way. So, happily, I had already on the docks a performance of Masterworks that I was in charge of. And so I said, fine, I'm going to do it my way. And then I thought about it and I said, you know, I've learned a lot from collaborations. It's deepened my artistic understanding. It's deepened my sense of connection with the community. So I decided I would relinquish some of my power and open it up to other artistic impulses. So I had to have my own strong vision of what I wanted, and I did. And then I brought in a dance company and talked with the choreographer. Many of you may know her, Barbara and Bill's daughter, Sarah Bush. And so that dance company came and danced in some of them. And Sarah and I talked about which movements to dance in, and we had different ideas, and we discussed it and waited until we sort of came to a mutual agreement on what we would, which ones, and then sort of the parameters of what we would do with the dancing and how much they would be involved and what sort of dancing. But then I said, you know, you make the final decision, let me know what you're going to do, and we will make it work somehow. Because there are all sorts of things which involve, like the tempo. I can't pick the tempo of the music without regard to what the dancers are doing, because it may become physically impossible if I change it too much. And there were four choruses involved. There was my chorus Masterworks, and then a high school chorus, and their director, and then another chorus, the Ballet Concert Chorale, which is in Livermore, and a community college chorus from Livermore. And there was an orchestra, and there were two children's choruses. Then there were also the soloists. There are three soloists, and I hired a director because I wanted there to be some kind of valid movement and drama in it, something which really connected with the music. So I hired a director to, and we talked, like much like I did with Sarah, we talked about my thoughts, what I thought might happen, certain parameters, and I said, go to town, figure out what's going to work and what you think will happen. And he had some crazy ideas. He said, oh, I want the chorus all to bring oven mitts at this point. And I said, this is Shades of New York. What have I gotten myself into? But, and he's Brazilian, very hot-tempered. And so I just waited and held my breath and said, you know, this will be a collaborative event. And maybe not everything is going to be exactly the way I want it. So dress rehearsal came. I'm conducting the orchestra. On comes the soloist. And there's one place, there's a part called the Roasting Swan. So the tenor, the poor tenor, the tenor soloist sits there for about 35 minutes, not making a peep, and then has to sing this absurdly high solo. And it's about a swan being roasted. And as it goes along, it describes the swan being put in the pot and getting hotter and hotter, and he's crying. And the chorus has responses. The men of the chorus, the tenors and basses, respond to him while he's doing this. The sopranos and altos don't have a part. So he, the director, had one soprano and, well, two sopranos in this case, one with a big pot, one with a big knife, chase the tenor soloist onto the stage, and all of the sopranos and altos who weren't singing opened up their oven mitts and did this. And I thought, this is just so stupid. And so I asked one of the conductors of one of the other groups if they could just conduct that movement so I could go out and look at this mess. And it worked beautifully. It worked beautifully. It made the music more alive than I've ever heard it before. And I've heard it a lot of times. And it didn't seem absurdly glitchy because it still matched the character of the music somehow. He also did some other wonderful things. My favorite movement in the work is the second to last movement, Ave Formosissima, which I used to not care for because it's pretty much all loud, all the chorus is screaming, the brass is playing, the strings are sawing away. And I've heard it many times where it was just like, oh, it's so loud, the chorus sounds so tired, I want to stop. But the core of this thing, there's so much about this, is courtly love and courtly lust, and peasant lust, courtly love, and the conflict between them. And this is sort of the resolution of all that, where the two characters who've been on either sides of the stage, the soprano in the red dress, which meant quite a bit back in those days, and the baritone, and they finally come together. It doesn't say they get married, but you can tell that they've come to a contract and a pact. So the stage, and we had talked, the stage director and I had talked a little bit about what I wanted to see, and I said I wanted somehow for everything to come together. So he had the baritone on one side, the soprano on the other, and they gradually came closer and closer together, and then he had five of the kids from the children's chorus come out and join them. Oh my gosh, I think I cried every time we did that performance because it was so touching. It just, again, it brought everything into focus. And then we did the last movement, which is a repeat of the first movement. The dance troupe came on and it gave everything this incredible energy. So I gave up a lot of my power. I accepted a lot of ideas from outside, even though I felt like I had really strong, good, valid ideas. I let these other ones come in, and it was a much, much better experience in the end, and I felt like I had done something good for the community, the performers, and for myself. I think the more we can find ways to collaborate until we find a shared vision, which may indeed become better than our own original vision, the better off we are. All right, I have more to say, but I'm happy to take questions or to have you sing. So, I will stop and open it up to any questions because I understand that's what y'all like to do here, and that's fine by me.
Thank you, Brian. So, excuse me, Dave, my spouse said I should try out for baritone today because I woke up with a cold, but we'd like to have time for questions. If you could keep your questions short so that we could get to more people, that would be very much appreciated. So are there any questions anywhere? Mac?
I'm really curious to know more about how you work with the piece. You know, you find a dissatisfaction with somebody else's as opposed to yours. How do you... What kind of things do you see and work with is my question. You know, when you do have a sense of, well, it should be this way, but I don't want it to be this way. I mean, what's the issues that come up?
So usually I have a really clear idea of what I think should happen. Not always, but very often. And somebody else brings a different concept, idea. And sometimes I have refrained, I think, most of my life from saying, oh, that's lousy, don't do that, and tried to indicate why I think it should be a different way and to find. And so my usual approach is to say, well, what if we tried it this way? So there was a cellist I worked with named Beth, who has become a good friend of mine. First time we worked together was on a trio. And every time I suggested, she'd say, let me try that. And after she played about three notes, she said, no, it doesn't work for me. And I thought, she does not want to collaborate. This is so frustrating. Fortunately, that performance got canceled. But Beth and I have worked together on many, and so to respond to the question, I felt like, okay, what I would say was, could we try this again as if it was more like a meditation? And so we'd play the same phrase, and she would have the same response. So then I'd try it again, and I'd say, well, maybe we could do this more like it was a dance, and a different portion of the piece. And we try that, same response, I just don't get this, not doing it for me. Concert got canceled. I've worked with Beth about a dozen times since then, and every time we've been completely able to merge our opinions. We had one where she had a big solo, and... it's like I didn't like what she was doing at the beginning, and I said, you know, I don't know that you need to be straight tone. So she was playing a very straight sound at the beginning on a long note. Said, I think if it was warmer, it would help what follows. She tried it. She kind of wrinkled her nose and said, okay. And so it works. Different. And other people, you just suggest something like, oh, yeah, that's great. And then a little bit later, somebody else will suggest something. And they'll say, the same performer will say, oh, yeah, that's great. And you just kind of... work with different people different ways until you find something. I try never to say that that's just wrong. Because who am I to say that's wrong?
Any other questions?
Two quick ones. Do you have to do the deciding about who's deciding at the beginning, or can you let that emerge? And second question, does there always have to be a decider in chief?
What great questions. So the first one I have struggled with a lot of times, because it seems really good if you've got a clear understanding at the outset that so-and-so is going to decide this and so-and-so is going to decide that. And I've decided that there are two elements in collaborations. There's an agreement, which is very often just money or who's going to conduct what, the sort of practical nuts and bolts. And then there's a covenant that you're going to work towards a shared vision, that you get a little bit of a boundary, maybe say we're not going to change the orchestration of this piece, but we're going to find what works for us together. And then that sort of answers your second question. Is there always a decider? No. I've done collaborations where we said, well, we'll just wait and see what happens in performance. It'll go one way this time and one way the other time. We've also done some where I conducted one performance and the other conductor did another performance. So each one was a little bit different. It's harder on the orchestra and the chorus if they're involved. But we haven't always made a final decision on that. We've let the real creative finalization happen in the moment of performance. Yeah.
So thank you. And thank you for showing us, letting us hear your creative process through the various things. I have two words that go with that. It's wonderful and it's marvelous. Only trouble is you stop. Thank you for the stride part of that. I'd never heard the stride part. Yeah. I didn't realize that goes back that way. Thank you for the metaphor of your musical collaboration / poli-sci. Right, very good, thank you. It's a good for today and forward. And the other thing, I was impressed with how extemporaneous your music goes. This isn't just written on the page. There's a four-letter word that describes Thelonious Monk's music as jazz, and you're describing jazz as best I know it, which is a very high compliment between my ears.
Thank you very much.
I thought I was in Thelonious Monk's head. No, the way you would evaluate. Da, 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 you know, I don't know what he did, but.
Thanks. I think I understand what you said. That's great.
How much carryover do you see to politics?
I will say that my response, as I've had a few days to Tuesday, is to do as much of this as I can, because this is building bridges between people. And even if it's blues and blues, they're slightly different shades of blue. The more we can do, the better. The more I can do, the better I will feel. And I'll tell you, even in the most horrific circumstances, there are little nuggets of shared vision. So I imagine you've all heard that there was that very awkward meeting between Trump and Obama. Well, apparently awkward. The photos looked awkward. And afterwards, Trump changed his... Well, imagine this. Trump changed his mind. But he said that he was not going to get rid of every bit of Obamacare. Some portions would stay. So something connected between the two of them, even through just unending insults on both parts. So I will do my very best to look for, and I also want to say, I avoided the radio entirely for 2 days, and then I started listening again to NPR and others, and it was almost all interviews with Trump supporters. And I've talked with friends who have friends who are Trump supporters, and I have friends who are Trump supporters, and relatives who are Trump supporters. And I have struggled, and I feel like I've come to a little bit of an understanding of why they are so hopeful, and that they feel very much the way many of us felt, or the way I felt 8 years ago, full of hope for changes which will make their life better. And I will continue in my work to try to find disparate elements and bring them together and find what common ground we can and share something from that. It's a challenge to me. It makes me feel deeper in my understanding of spirituality, and I think it's a better thing for the world.